You may have kids, you may have a wife that loves you very much, but like there's something not wired right and you're going down this path. So having a dog there, you look down at the dog and you're like, I can't leave this dog. This dog needs me.
Never quit radio.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the TNQ podcast. I'm your host, Marcus Luttrell. Every week, it's my job to fire you up, to ignite the legend inside of you, and to push you to your greatness. Join me every week as I take you into my briefing room with some of the most hard-charging people on the planet. They're going to show you how to embrace the suck of life, teach you the values of working your ass off, and charge through whatever life throws at you. This is the Team Never Quit podcast. So buckle up, Buttercup.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of the Team Never Quit podcast. As always, thank you guys for listening and watching, and please don't forget to hit that like and subscribe button. So today, before we get to our very special guest, let's kick it off with our usual Patreon question of the day. And I like this one today. So, if you were trapped on an island forever, who would you choose to be with you? They have to be a celebrity.
Marcus.
What celebrity would you choose?
I want my very own celebrity, Marcus Luttrell.
I mean, the common sense person in me would say like Bear Grylls. Bear Grylls. Yeah, exactly. Bear Grylls. Like somebody, yeah.
As soon as he said deserted island.
Yeah.
The first person to roll in my head was Bear.
Yeah, or that there was another show with another guy.
Cody,
that
right?
Yeah, that used to be put into like really remote areas.
What happened
areas.
To those dudes, man?
I
watched that one too.
Yeah.
Bear Grylls.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think if we could get if Bear Grylls could somehow coach something with maybe Gordon Ramsay. And
yeah.
They had a nephew that was a badass like both them.
Yeah. Have you seen Gordon Ramsay's Uncharted, where he goes out into remote areas and like?
I only catch glimpses of those because the time I have in front of TV now.
That's a great idea for a show. We should pitch that to somebody.
You know what I'm talking about?
Like, yeah,
one of them dudes, but Bear Grylls most certainly.
Right.
Hunter's shaking his head. I'm thinking you want a woman.
No.
Oh hell, man! No. All right. Now you're being weird.
No, I would choose.
Okay, so then let me go. I'm gonna have to go with Martha Stewart.
I feel like that would be useless.
I would like Joe Rogan. I think the conversations we could have would just be endless. We'd go into so many conspiracies. We'd just have the best time. And
he hunts.
He can hold his own. I mean, we can hold our own, still stay alive, but also get to have fun with it, you know?
All right, the Podfather, right? That's what you're going after?
The Podfather.
He's a good one to have. He's a good one to have.
I'm still sticking with mine. You.
I love you too, baby.
I love you. All right, that was a good Patreon question.
All right, let's get into this. So thanks for coming on here and doing this.
Thanks for having me.
A few of the things that you started up, one of them I'm real passionate about. Didn't start off that way, but I kind of had to live the life to understand the life. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
So let's back up a little bit. Tell us a little bit, where are you from? Where'd you come out of?
North Texas. So my family's ranch is about an hour south of Dallas near Corsicana.
Okay.
In between Barry and M House. So seventh generation Texan. I know Texans are like CrossFitters. They love to tell you how far back their lineage goes. But Yeah. Navarro County actually was named after a great ancestor of mine, Samuel Wilson, settled Navarro County with Jose Navarro.
Yeah, so I'll go all back and forth with you all day about history of the families. Yeah. Now that you can trace your ancestry and everything, this is my favorite thing to do, because that's what arguments are supposed to be about. Like, ours was the first one here.
Yeah.
I lived in Waxahachie for a little while, which isn't too far from there.
It was 25 minutes.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
That's a great historic town. If anybody loves Texas history, Waxahachie has a lot of really good preserved history there.
Yeah. And it's ripe for like a renovation of their downtown area, like Corsicana too, because Corsicana is a little depressed right now, to be honest, when you go through there. But
why? What happened? Because it's right there at the bend. I don't feel like it gets enough attention.
It's the highway 45 just kind of destroyed Corsicana.
It just turns right before you get in there, right?
Yeah, 45, like the business loop. And
what did 75 used to go through there? Is that
no, I don't think so, because it's north on 45. 75 is a little further north than Corsicana.
I feel like when 45 came through, because it's like an hour south of Dallas or so. When people are either leaving Dallas, usually going to Houston or going to Houston to Dallas, nobody wants to stop right outside of Dallas. It's like, let's just get there.
That's a good point. Especially because Ennis is like the fast food mecca.
Yeah, but you want to speak there. Yeah. I tell you what, man, the police there are serious about that. I'm buddies with all of them for that very reason.
Absolutely right.
They don't play around, man. They're waiting on you.
Yeah. I mean,
God bless them dudes, man.
My great-grandfather, I didn't know this until years ago, but my great grandfather was actually the congressman for Texas 6, Congressman Elsie's current district now. And I didn't know that until I started getting involved in policy and politics. And my dad was like, oh, hey, did you know this? And I was like, no, why did you never tell me this?
They don't bring like that up.
Yeah. I mean,
one generation removed, they don't talk about that cool stuff. I guess because we thought it was boring when we were kids. I can't figure it out.
My great grandfather was a state rep for Louisiana.
Yeah.
And I never knew it until Morgan got elected, and then my grandmother was like, oh, did you know your great-grandfather was the rep for Louisiana? I was like, no, I had no idea.
To your point, though, I love genealogy. When COVID hit, I just did so much, and I had free time on my hands. I just started doing genealogical research. I forget who said it, but somebody said it's a humbling experience because you can research these people that have full and complete lives, and there's very little records of their existence, right? So it kind of it does a good job of humbling you, these people that have all this stuff.
I've gone really far into the rabbit hole of my genealogy and Marcus's. And I get stuck there. I just want to live in that hole of finding out who everybody was. And if I could, I would travel and go to all the courthouses and dig up wills and different things. Cause I find it so interesting.
Yeah, it really is. I love it.
Yeah. That's awesome. Okay, so you grew up in that area, and then...
Texas A&M. But I actually joined the military before I went back. I was enlisted, so I went straight out of high school.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah.
Because I'm training a kid right now, and he's kind of, what do you want to do? It's difficult. I don't know if you had this problem, but when I was in high school, I had no idea what to do.
Yeah.
I didn't think I was smart enough to get through all the colleges, but I was good enough to get in. It was one of those. Some of those kids, it's like, hey, man, you're going to do great. And, and they did do great. I didn't have the study habit, so I was always hesitant.
Yeah.
So you, when you came out of high school, you went straight into the military?
Well, so my mom and my dad got divorced when I was three. So I spent summers on the ranch with my dad, baling hay in the Texas heat. And then school years with my mom. And I have two older sisters.
Where'd she live?
Euless, so right smack dab outside of the DFW airport, pretty much. And but I had two older sisters and my mom, so I was swimming in the estrogen ocean during the school year. And I got involved in Boy Scouts and really relished all the service projects and things like that we did. So I felt I didn't know what I wanted to do out of high school.
How far did you go in the Scouts?
I was an Eagle Scout.
Yeah. Okay, so that's a big deal.
Yeah. It's a huge deal. I think more people need to talk about their Eagle Scout. I ran across an
Eagle the other day.
Yeah.
In Mississippi. Found out he was an Eagle Scout just haphazardly. I don't know how it even came up in conversation, but y'all need to, that's a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Well, they give, when you enlist, they give you a rank, one rank.
They absolutely, in the military, that's right. They bump you up another one. If you show that sucker to police officers, if people read that on resumes, I'm talking about heads of bank, heads of state.
Yeah. Yeah.
If they see that at that age to complete that task, and this family, when the kids are raising up, I was like, hey man, you're going to be a Boy Scout and get your black belt. Call you a Black Eagle. I mean, you know what I'm talking about? If you have those two things, if you can be an Eagle Scout, you can get your black belt. By the time you're 18, you got your driver's license, I don't worry about you.
Yeah.
I mean, I just think those two things get you ready for life.
I mean, I agree. And because I spent school years with my mom, I didn't have a positive male influence during this year, except for my scoutmasters and football coaches. And, I was self-aware enough to know at the time that I probably wouldn't take college too seriously, need a little kick in the pants. And I didn't want to do what my sisters did, which was, work two jobs while they were in college, take out loans and whatever. So I said, if I decide to go back to college, I'll have the GI Bill, right? And my mom said, you can either get a job, join the military, or go to school, but you're not staying in my house after 18. So I had to make a choice.
Mm-hmm. Most people.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that was a great option.
Almost everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Unless you're born into a trade or a family trade.
Yeah.
And those aren't bad options.
No, they're not.
Now that I know what I know and how fast that goes,
yeah.
and the doors it opens up, there's not a problem with it.
Well, and today so many of my peers are bogged down by like student loan debt and can't buy a house and all this stuff. And I financially, I feel like I'm so much more ahead of my peers because I had those resources. Mm-hmm. And 80% of the military is enlisted, and a lot of them come from disadvantaged backgrounds where they don't have, you know, they're living paycheck to paycheck or parents or
military fixes freedom. That.
Yeah. Military is a great option for everyone. Anything. No matter what you don't know what
to do. Yeah.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah.
You just go and you figure it out while you're there, and then you can go to college for free,
yeah.
Or you can, like, there's so many other things you can do.
Well, the intangible benefit of like having a group of people that come from all walks of life, and honestly, America could use more of this because you come from such diverse backgrounds and you forget all of your differences and your bullshit to accomplish a mission. Does. Right.
100%, and, yeah, absolutely.
And have people that you serve with that are lifelong friends and are a support group, which frankly I think is why veterans kind of struggle when they get out, is because they lose that support system and friends that they serve with and everything like that. But
it's sad to see how, like, we went to visit the in Coronado, the SEAL team base, and they were telling us, or it was actually the Buds compound, and they were telling us that recruitment is at like an all-time low right now. And it's basically for every branch. And it sucks because kids these days, they want to do something on the coup. They want to do easy.
Yeah.
Whatever is the easiest, let me slide by. And it honestly, it drives me crazy. Like, just go and do some work. It's a couple of years of time and you meet awesome people.
Yeah.
And then you get the skills and the funding to be able to do whatever after.
Yeah. Well, Mission Roll Call, I'm executive director of this national organization, Mission Roll Call. We commissioned a national research study last year that said that 67% of Gen Z does not know a veteran or somebody on active duty. And military service is becoming a family business. You have 80% of veterans reporting an immediate family member that served, and like less than 1% serving on active duty in any given year. So the further and further away.
When that separated. When did that schism happen? Do we know what year that was? 60s? 70s after Vietnam?
No, I mean, it it would have to have been. That's a good question.
I didn't know. There wasn't supposed to be a test. I was curious because I never thought about it until you said it like that.
Yeah.
But there had to be a point to when, hey, we do this in our family, and then.
Yeah.
There's so many people that don't when you say you don't understand that, and there are people like, how could you not see that? How could you not understand? They don't. Yeah. They just don't. It's a way of life.
It's an all volunteer force. You have to volunteer. Live
a life in America and exist outside of the military and all that violence and everything like that, and just completely not understand us.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah. It's that old saying, from the inside, you can't explain it. From the outside, you can't understand it.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit, unless you know somebody that either is doing it or did it.
How about that for a duality? And now you can understand and why those two have friction.
Yeah.
Because after a while, there has to be, there's some animosity there.
Yeah.
So you were in Eagle Scouts, and then you decided to go to the military from there?
Yeah, so my now brother-in-law, then my sister's boyfriend, honestly, he was the only person I knew that had served. He was a Marine, was in the First Battle of Fallujah, and I really looked up and respected him. And so that's kind of why I chose the Marine Corps.
So that's what got you? I like asking guys now.
Yeah.
So he was a Storm, right? You said Fallujah?
No. He was in the First Battle of Fallujah 03 or 4.
So it was GY.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's usually there's something that grabs you.
Yeah.
Whether it's a documentary back then or a TV show or somebody you know.
Yeah.
It's there's something, a hitch that gets you.
Even as a kid, like I loved military history. I loved history generally and the Boy Scouts. Like, I knew I wanted to serve somehow. I just didn't know what branch I wanted to serve in. And again, because he was the only person I knew and I really respected him and still respect him, obviously, as a person. That was what drew me more than anything else.
He's a Marine?
Yeah.
He looked like a Marine?
Yeah. We have the best dress uniforms.
Yeah, I was going to say, you have the jawline.
Y'all do have the best uniforms. Yeah,
I mean, this is a well-known fact. I'm real open about talking about it, too. I mean, you got to get them in there somehow.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
They got to get you guys somehow. And with anything about the Corps, they look sharp.
Uh-huh.
They even look sharp after they get out.
Yeah.
We were doing an event, and there was two Marines with me. One was 98, and the other one was 101. Both of them are colonels, full birds. And when I stepped and looked at them, man, I mean, they were khakied out top to bottom, and the razor sharp seam all the way down. You could, those buckles were shined up. They looked at that age, just sharp. I mean, you.
That uniform has gotten so many guys and girls. It's just, you know, yeah. It's like, you remember
you
that old,
got lucky on that one, man.
That old commercial with the guy in the dress uniform that like slays a dragon with the NCO sword or something like that.
That's right. I forgot about that commercial.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ours are great. Navy. No, they're not. So anytime I give you guys compliments, it's because I'm thinking about how ours are, you know, the Cracker Jacks, they're for terrific. And why would you put 13 buttons on a pair of pants when you know that sailors love to drink beer?
About the buttons.
That's a joke. Like that's a running joke on Navy guys is we love to drink beer and there's 13 buttons across those pants. Yeah. Try getting them suckers undone quick.
Yeah, that doesn't make a lot of sense to us. Yeah.
Somebody had to come up. They had a great sense of humor.
What year did you enlist?
2008.
Oh, yeah. You're young.
Well, you know, the gray hair throws people off, but that's what happens when you work and live in D.C. It's a stressful town and, you know, it gives you gray hairs. But yeah, 2008 and served for 6 years, did a deployment to Afghanistan in 2011. So that was like peak surge down in Helmand Province. And
I was going to say, 10-11 is a hard year.
Yeah. To be honest with you, I was a diesel mechanic by trade and I spent most of the time on fobs and things like that. But I got OJT'd as a wrecker operator, which is essentially like a military tow truck. So yeah. I did that a handful of times. And honestly, my military service is not anything special, and it's not anything that was, you know, super high speed.
Yeah, all you guys always say that, man, so I'm going to cut you off right there. And in Afghanistan in those years, especially the wreckers, like you're talking about like Pathfinders. Is that what you're rolling with? Get out anytime something on the routes and clear all
that
stuff?
Yeah.
All right, they don't give... There's a lot of things y'all don't know about the military. There's a lot of organizations they don't ever talk about. One of them is what that is. Like before we would go out, I mean, they still have to send these dudes out to, because there's bombs everywhere. Mm. And to watch those guys go out and come back in just blown to pieces. That was the craziest job, I thought, dealing with the explosives.
Or even just transporting things, you know, from one fob to another. I would think
the majority of the casualties in GWAT came from, you know, fuel convoys. And
that was the worst. When we would land and you'd have to transpo to a different fob, and there could be a route that was 5 miles long. If that, 3 miles to get to here to there.
Yeah.
And we would have to go 400 miles out of the way because there was so much munitions in there.
And at one time, wrecker operators, and again, like I that wasn't my primary job, so I didn't do that like all day, every day, the entire deployment or anything. But it was, I think, the second highest fatality rate in the Marine Corps from 2009 to 2011.
Gosh.
Because like they knew that we were going to go out when things got blown up and, you know, try to recover them and bring them back to base. Secondary IEDs and ambushes.
That's when they got good on us. When those IRLs came in, there would be those second tertiary explosions because they'd bait. There'd be a bait up, pull somebody in, then everyone would come in to get that stuff. Man, they'd hit them suckers too.
Yeah. Well, I think part of the origin of my story and how I got involved in veteran advocacy, though, like during the last part of the deployment, as our replacements were coming in and taking over operational responsibility, I volunteered a lot of my time because we went from working 12, 15, 16 hours a day to like 8. And I was like, I'm bored. I need to do something else. So I went to go volunteer at the Bastion Trauma Center because in my mind, when I got back, I was entertaining the idea of going to be an EMT or a firefighter or something along those lines. So I wanted to kind of get a taste for what that was like. Obviously, it's a little different, a trauma center in a war zone, than like something you would do back here. A lot of that stuck with me more than anything else was working at Bastion.
That's where I spent my free time.
Yeah.
That's where I spent my free time. I'd go in there work in those clinics.
Yeah.
And in the ORs, and you see them stuff that come in. Because we would work, a lot of people don't know this, but we work on the enemy.
Yeah.
Or if civilians get hurt, local they can walk nationals, up to the front gate. Yeah, they can walk up to the front gate and get the same medical care we do.
Yeah.
Which is so
I learned some
weird
of my best
me.
Trauma skills working in there. The doctors were great, too, because they're military docs.
Yeah.
So if you're a medic or if you're trying to learn that stuff, that's when I really honed in on my EMT skills.
Yeah.
I was doing that.
And I wasn't a doctor or a nurse or anything like that. I just was in there to learn and do anything I could to help. So, like, part of what got me was we had... like kids that would come in on medevacs and there was like a 6-7 year old that came in and I remember I mean, he didn't have a chance. He had lost too much blood before he came in, right? But he was sitting there bleeding out, and the doctors were just like, talk to him, and just make him feel comfortable. So I was like trying to reassure him, and I grabbed his hand, and he had this Zippo, I don't know if it's fake or it's real, I still have it, but this Zippo lighter that I'm assuming another Marine had like given to him. Mm. And you're sitting there, and you just like feel the life go out of him, right? And it's like stuff like that that just tends to stick with you a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
Well, that's what gets everybody in war. It's not what they, it's not fighting.
Yeah.
That's not what gets you.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Because that's what you train for.
Yeah. That, boom. Right there. There's a, I call it the void. Yeah. Man, there's integrum spaces in there that we get stuck in that you just kind of like, you know. So why? I say all the time, like, I never even heard of it.
Yeah.
Why don't you train for.
You can't.
That kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many variables that go into that. And then the, especially when we get over to wherever it is we're going, because you can't really train for that. And then you throw the people in the mix with how they react.
Yeah.
Because here's the one thing the movies can't do and no one will ever be able to imitate is the attitudes that we have when we're fighting a war. You can't replicate that unless you're actually in the war.
Yeah.
And that's the toughest thing to get back when we come back here is switching that frame of mind, that frame of reference back over. That's why a lot of the guys stay hidden. They go inside because of that.
Well, you spend 13 weeks at boot camp, then you go to combat training, job school, all this stuff. Cumulatively, it could be 6 months to a year and a half, 2 years when you account for, you know, all the training that Special Operations does before they go out into the fleet. You spend so much time training, and unless you go Skill Bridge or something like that, there, I mean, the transition assistance program is garbage.
Yeah, we need to fix that. That's kind of, I'm on board with that too. And just think about how long it takes to take a puppy after it's old enough to train and to where it'll kill. It's combat ready. That's not very long.
Yeah.
So think about how long we train humans. We do that for years. And then you send them out to fight. Man, you can't believe what that did to them.
This is making me think of one of Marcus's teammates he was in buds with, Dan Luna. He has come up with this concept of training for pre-trauma instead of just being recovered, you know, like having a reaction to trauma, but actually training before that on all of these levels. And he has a whole program that he does with that. And I think it's so interesting for things like that, specifically things that are not typically trained about or worked with, but all of the things that have come back, and actually turning that into a program.
I know there's a guy, Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman, who wrote a couple of books on war, on combat.
Yeah, I know who he is.
Yeah, I mean, I read his book.
He taught us how to kill.
Yeah.
That's who taught us how to kill.
Yeah. He was the one that did all the research on the military's conditioning after Vietnam because there were so many conscientious objectors and people and like psychologically teaching people how to
killing is not a physical. Yeah. That part's easy.
Didn't
that part's easy, man? It's the mind thing that he taught us.
Dave Grossman interviewed like for the military, not for a podcast or anything. But he's
my doc.
He was one of his docs. Yeah,
was it really?
Absolutely.
Wow.
Oh, I know that man.
Yeah.
When I say he trained us, he did. Mm-hmm. I got face to face with that man, especially when I got back.
I've never met him, but his books are...
On killing and on combat.
Yeah.
I have them in the library.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They're really good.
They're fantastic. When we were getting... Yeah, if you could retro that one back around. So the reverse of that is what we need to implement now.
Right. Like a reverse boot camp. I've talked about this, you know.
I was going back and forth with some of my guys. I was like, the last 2 years should be an enlistment for you to get out.
Yeah. Well, your brother made a great...
You're going to a school. You're going to college. What do you want to do? What do you want to do? Not what your options are. What do you want to do?
Yeah.
And we market our own people. And then we send them to the universities and all that. I don't know why we can do everything else.
Yeah.
I don't know why that
part... Well, your brother made a great point at a congressional hearing last week or the week before where he said, from birth up to the point where you get out, right... pretty much everything's handled. Even when you're in the military and when you're a kid, like people feed you, people clothe you, people You know, you go to school, there's discipline, whatever. And then, you know, men and women get out and they have to learn how to kind of be an adult again. They've got to learn how to handle their finances. And, of course, this is usually the people that were in for one or two enlistment, not people that stay in for 20, because they have to learn how to do this stuff. Mm-hmm. But, so many of these people that I mentioned come from disadvantaged backgrounds and they never have to, they've never had a steady paycheck before and they've never had housing, you know, taken care of, and they get out and they have to relearn kind of all this stuff. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So when you got out, you went straight to college, or how did you find
yourself? I got out in 2014. I didn't have a job, wasn't in school, was going through.
Where'd you come out at? Where'd your last station at? California?
Well, So I was actually, after I got back from Afghanistan, I was in a reserve unit in Abilene, Texas, at Dyess Air Force.
So that's another way that I was talking to this kid. Is, hey, reserves are great too.
Yeah. Because
you can actually go to college and be in the reserves, yeah. And they take care of you.
Yeah. Reserves are tough though, because you have to balance like these two lives. And
the Army reserves, Marine Corps reserves.
Yeah, it's the same thing. I mean,
what about the Air Force reserves? I feel like
I don't know. That might be.
You know what I mean? Let's be real here. I feel like being in the Air Force reserves would be the place to be to go to college.
Yeah, I mean, I lived in DFW, and my reserve unit was in Abilene, and then so occasionally they'd change up their drill schedules on you, so you'd have to tell your civilian employer or your family, or you'd go do your 2-week annual training or whatever. It was pretty disruptive of trying to go to school and have a job and things like that. So that came with its own unique set of challenges. But I tried to, you know, go back to school and get some credits done, and went to the VA for some of the issues that I was dealing with, and they prescribed me SSRIs, which were terrible. So then I got out finally in 2014, and like I said, I at the time didn't have a job and wasn't in school, had just finalized like a pretty nasty divorce. And yeah, it was.
You hooked yourself up, huh?
I got my standard issue.
Yeah, right. Standard issue divorce. Right there.
Yeah.
As soon as you said that, I was like, "Good job."
It was.
Well done, Marine.
I mean, it was like one of my toughest periods. So April.
I'm not laughing at you, man. I'm laughing.
No, I get it. Because I mean, you've been there.
I've seen
too,
you guys right? go through that, man. It's the it's the hardest part for a Marine's life.
Yeah, and my girlfriend will ask me, like, why'd you do that? And I'm like, I honestly, looking back on it, like, I was
like,
young and dumb.
And we're like, hey, bro, what?
Yeah.
And like, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't. It's like a thing that happens.
It's just, yeah. But, you know, I was probably drinking too much at the time.
No, and, I don't worry about that.
And, like...
Not while you're in.
I mean, no, I mean when I was out.
Okay,
and
yeah,
I was one of the... I got out, and so, you know, one night I spiraled down, and I was probably about that far away from... you know, being a suicide statistic, and I had another Marine that came, banged on my door, and I was actually surprised that him banging on my door didn't, like, jerk my finger, but he stayed with me the night, obviously knew what was going on, and I can't really explain it, except for to say the next morning, I woke up, I had been drinking too much, and I wasn't hungover at all, I was, like, very clear, and my mindset went from, I have nothing, to I have the opportunity to do anything, because I wasn't tethered to anything anymore. I didn't have anything tying me down. And 2 Timothy 1:7, which is, for God doesn't give us spirit of fear and timidity, but of power, love, and self-discipline, was like the verse that stuck into my head.
It's a good one.
And I said, you know, I've got to figure out a way to figure out what I actually want to do now, and find my purpose again, and then also deal with the symptoms of post-traumatic stress. And I had, you know, heard your story with Daisy and everything, and I had a friend of mine who had a service dog. And so I stopped taking the pills, which had exacerbated my issues, and went that route. But I had to pay like 10 grand of my own money to get Kaya. It's a German Shepherd. But
where'd you get her from?
Breeder up in Dallas. And I used the last of my deployment money and... went to the litter, and the trainer said, I can work with this one, or this one. And I wanted the female. She was the only female. But the VA didn't provide any funding for that. And
no, they don't do that.
Yeah. Well, they do now, but...
not then, though.
Yeah, no, not then at all. And
I don't know, it was different. It's like the VA has to change when the wars change.
Yeah.
Is that fair to say that?
100%. I mean, people are surviving wounds in the GWAT that they would never have survived before.
Oh!
Right?
Well, yeah, we gave them plenty to work on. And plus, we had civilians backing us up.
Yeah.
And that whole component. And I think that everything is going through a kind of an evolution, just like the wars have ended. And the VA, it just got hammered. I mean, two wars for 20 years. Look how many of us are going in there.
Yeah.
just wearing that body armor, what it did to our spines and everything like that. I'm lucky now. I have a brand new one, but I just remember, especially when we were out in the cities, having to run block to block, and you just see those, just like all those weights just pile driving down on top of you. It's the craziest thing. You don't think about it when you're in there. If somebody was asking me this morning at breakfast, like, hey, how's the pain compared to... I was like, I think we've always been in pain. We just didn't focus on it back then. And now we don't have anything in front of us to capture the pain.
Yeah.
So we concentrate on it.
Yeah.
So did the breeder train her?
No. So another friend of mine was the actual trainer. So I took Kaya for about a month to bond with her, teach her, you know, potty train her, all that stuff. And then she went off to get trained. So she was specifically trained to recognize when I was having a nightmare, and she'd jump up in bed and lick my face and wake me up and stay with me until I, you know, heart rate went down and everything. Or she would recognize when I was having an anxiety attack and would do what's called animal assisted intervention, where she'd like get up in my face and, you know, distract me essentially to keep that snowball effect of whatever was happening from getting worse. So she worked great for me. And that's kind of why I went off and started advocating for service dogs for veterans, because I thought it was crap. I had to pay as much money as I did to get it. And, like, this is a viable option. If you go on the VA's own website, it'll tell you that pills and therapy only work, like, 50% of the time. So why are we not exploring other options? Like, I know there's been a lot of discussion, not only just about service dogs, but about descheduling cannabis so that we could research it. Because anecdotally, I know a lot of veterans that have used that and quit drinking entirely, and it helped them sleep better, and it helped them do all these other things. Psychedelics, we're having a conversation in Congress about that now. There's so many other, you know, hyperbaric was a thing for a minute or whatever. There's other things that we can do that don't have the negative side effects of pills. And a lot of people don't like prolonged exposure and all that stuff. So
those are the worst. Pills?
Yeah.
Freaking worst, man.
Yeah. Terrible. Like,
so what about all of the nonprofits that have service dogs? Can't the VA just work directly with those?
And like all those industries, they have, the VA has the names of all those. And when one of our guys or girls comes into the VA and checks in when they're coming out, when I was issued my service dog, that's what I thought was happening. But in reality, what was going down was I was getting issued to him. So I had to switch it around. Like, I was a dog walker, and this son of a gun got to go around the globe. I mean, I took him everywhere, bro. I mean, you know, I'm talking high-end hotels. He had his own fan page. This, if I die, I want to come back as one of my dogs.
Oh, yeah.
Especially that sucker.
Yeah. Yeah.
Daisy got it hard because she was really young when she was killed.
Yeah, brand new.
And then Marcus got Rigby, that ended up being with him for 12 years. And
Mr. Rigby, through all of that, through all the movie, getting out of the military, and it was the best because it gives you something to focus on.
Yeah. Well, I often tell people, if you've ever owned a dog, you know they're therapeutic, right? I mean, when fingers meet fur, something magical happens. But especially trained dogs can help you with the specific symptoms. But, like, if you find yourself at that point where you got a gun in your mouth or you're thinking about, you know, getting drunk and taking a bunch of pills or something like that. You know, I've had to talk during the Afghanistan withdrawal. I had to talk down a couple of guys that were like, what the fuck did we do all this for? You know? And you find yourself when you're in that position, like, alone, you feel unlovable. You feel like nobody cares, which may be the farthest thing from the truth. You may have kids, you may have a wife that loves you very much, but, like, there's something not wired right, and you're going down this path. So having a dog there, you look down at the dog and you're like, I can't leave this dog. This dog needs me.
Oh, that's because it's unconditional love.
Yeah, exactly.
That's if you have one of those, you'll see what unconditional love is.
Yeah.
And when you can't, if he's sitting there looking at you, then you're thinking about something else. Actually, you're thinking about something that loves you. That's why you can always focus on those suckers.
Yeah.
And I mean, when Rigby, this was the hardest part, but this is the best part for veterans. But it's like, you know, you learn about death again and again, right? And I had to put him down.
Yeah.
It was so hard.
We mourned his death. And I remember he was my best friend. We went everywhere. I talked to him probably more than I talked to anybody. He never said one word to me.
Yeah.
That sucker never said one
word
to me.
But he understood you.
He did. People think, like, if you can teach a dog to sit and they know what that word is and you're with them, the thing about service dogs, you're always with them.
Yeah.
You don't think they learn what you're saying?
Mm-hmm.
They sure do. And they'll show up when they have that look on their face. And I didn't know this either, but service dogs, and I guess most dogs, man, they have bad days. They have attitudes. They can throw you attitude. If they're so inclined, if you know what you're looking at.
Yeah.
Dude, Mr. Rigby would clown me sometimes and just have these looks on his face. And I knew what they say. I knew what he was saying when he'd do it. And it was the best thing. It's almost like I went through that period of transition, and I didn't have the hard part. It was because of him.
I like to say that, our connection with dogs, especially a service dog, is a lot like our relationship with God, right? There's a different level of consciousness. You're never going to be able to explain the internet to a dog like you're never going to be able to explain heaven to a human. You're not going to get there. And we may sin, the dog may poop on your floor or whatever, but you still love them unconditionally. It's a very pure relationship that is built off unconditional love and in its very kind of pure form.
Sure. It's the perfect example of God's love. It's what dog and God's the same word back and forth.
Yeah.
It's like when you look at it, it's like, I wonder what God's love looks like. Probably just like that.
Yeah.
Always happy to see you. Mm-hmm. You know, even if you don't, if you talk down to him and try to kick him in the ass and all that, they're just like, hey, he's like, hey, what's up? Let's go do something.
Yeah.
One of the stories that I always go back to was when Marcus and I first got together, Rigby went everywhere with us. And we had just come back from somewhere, I don't know where, but it was hotter than heck in Texas, maybe August or so. It was real, real hot. And Rigby was in the back seat of the truck. We get home. I think we were unloading groceries or something. I don't know what it was. Anyway, we go inside, and after maybe an hour or so, we're like, where's Rigby? Marcus goes back to the truck, opens the door, and Rigby's just smiling and wagging his tail.
Hey,
and
Marcus, nice to see you again.
Yeah. Marcus said, we were married by then. He goes, if I left my wife in the truck for an hour,
100%.
She would be like, what the? So
lit. He was like, hey, man, what's up? Where are we going? I've been waiting. Yeah. I'm still sitting here.
I thought this was what I was supposed to be doing. Yeah.
I wish I was half the man that dog thought I was, too. You know what I'm talking about? Yeah. My wife, she'd have shot me through the door.
And he was so happy to see Marcus. Yeah. And I'm like, yeah, I would be pissed at you. So it really does show this different kind of love that the dogs
always
have.
Willing to go on any adventure.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that, and again, that's why I did the PAWS Act and wrote that. And then Congressman DeSantis was the one that sponsored the original version of the bill. Senator Tom Tillis, North Carolina, did the Senate version of the bill. And the original version, which would have had the VA provide grant funding directly to veteran organizations that provide these dogs, Canines for Warriors, Warrior Canine Connection, Labs for Liberty, all these organizations.
Southeastern Guide Dogs.
That's where I get. But the VA in all its wisdom opposed it. Not enough scientific evidence to prove that dogs can help.
Oh, well, that's what we're doing.
Yeah.
We're setting the examples and getting all the literature and the data just by doing it ourselves, and then we can pass it to them. If that's what we have to do, that's what we'll do.
Well, so the workaround for them, though, was like, you know, we're not going to provide funding originally. So the compromise version of the PAWS Act was, we'll have veterans train the dogs, and the training will be the therapy, and then they'll still get to keep the dogs at the end of the training.
Oh, it's two different types of training.
Right. But I was also a little... I was like, okay. I mean, I'm not going to fight it because it gets more dogs in the hands of veterans.
I get that.
But also, there's less evidence to prove that training dogs is helpful than the dogs themselves.
Probably piss you off even more.
Yeah.
Train that sucker down.
Yeah. And so that was that passed in August of 2021. So that was kind of a rough spot in that whole Afghanistan.
But you know how it is with us, kind of the veterans thing. It's small movements, right?
Yeah.
So just getting little things done. So now that it's in there, say.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we can course correct this now and course correct that.
So what was the final PAWS Act that went through?
Yeah, so it was a pilot program because Congress, you know, a lot of times if they want to slow roll something, pilot programs are kind of the thing. But a pilot program at 5 different sites around the country where the VA provides funding for service dog organizations that provide, you know, the training that veterans can come out and train the dogs, and then they ultimately get to keep their dogs. It's almost finished, and then hopefully we reauthorize a program in a permanent way and kind of expand it.
That's good.
Yeah.
It needs to be a competition between those academies, too, once I think with the military, and that keeps them sharp.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like if you go into the, when you check out of the military, which shouldn't, that shouldn't be a thing. Once you come in, we got you. Like service should be, we got your number. You get to put your civilian clothes in, go live in your town and be a great citizen.
Yeah.
But we got an exit package. On the way out, we're going to send you to school if that's where you want to go. Oh, you get a dog, by the way. I don't care if you want one or not.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Unless you're allergic to them suckers, but maybe who cares? Just suck it up and get it done. You know, it's a life stuff. Yeah. And that'll give you something else to worry about than worrying about dumb stuff.
Yeah.
How did you learn how to write policy? And
I was interning on Capitol Hill at the time. And, you know, this is part of my, this is my never quit story, right? Mm-hmm. Is I got laughed at a lot because I didn't know how to write policy or anything. I had help from, you know, lawyers that worked on Capitol Hill and say, like, this is what I want to do. Can you help me craft it this way? And DeSantis's office was helpful at the time in crafting that. And I worked with them a lot. But it was me. I was still a student at Texas A&M at the time. And I was flying back and forth to D.C. to advocate for this, spending my own money because I wasn't doing it on behalf of any organization or anything like that. Flying back and meeting with members of Congress, DeSantis's office would be like, hey, can you come meet with these people and these people? So I'd fly from College Station to D.C. and I was like crowdfunding support to try to fund these flights to get up here and do that.
So how did you get hooked up with DeSantis's office when you were from Texas?
He, I mean, just mutual friends. Like a lot of times on Capitol Hill, it's like, who knows who? And I talked to a bunch of different people and said, this is what I want to do. Are you guys interested in sponsoring this? And a lot of people said, well, we're not on the VA committee or, you know, this isn't a historic, we don't have anything in our district. And at the time, DeSantis was, I mean, obviously he's a veteran. He had Canines for Warriors in his district. And so, when I brought the idea to him and his office, they were like, yeah, absolutely. Let's do this. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of how that worked out. Like I said, I was a student and would fly back and forth. Funny story is that I was doing political science at A&M at the time. And I was missing a lot of class because I was flying back and forth. And one of my professors, there was an exam day, didn't believe me that I was going to D.C. to like advocate. So I actually still have a like get out of class note from his office saying that like I could, you know, leave and go do that. And I walked in and I gave it to my professor and he was like, okay, you're good.
Oh my gosh, how funny. So did you actually go, like, because we did this recently and I never knew that this existed. When you're wanting to kind of crowdfund and get people, get congressmen and senators on board for something, you literally have to go door to door and just meet with different staff members. Is that what you did?
Yeah, essentially. I mean, I had help because Kaya was a cute dog, right? And she was always going with me.
What was she?
A German Shepherd. Mm. So I like to say that, I was the person that was doing the argument, the arguing about it and trying to get people to support. She was really the closer. Mm. And at one point we met with then Speaker Paul Ryan, who called her the most powerful lobbyist on the Hill because you know, we'd walk into offices and people would be like, oh, your dog's beautiful. Like, of course, I'll support this. And
just sign right there. There's right, the dog.
Exactly.
They do that.
I would go into members of Congress's office and they'd be like, oh, I'm already going to support your bill. Can I just cuddle with your dog for like 5 minutes? And I was like, yep, as long as you're co-sponsoring it. It
calms everything down.
Yeah, it
does. There's a few congressmen you'd see and every now and again, I'd go into some office and someone have a dog. It just kind of levels the playing field, whatever that is. It sure, it does.
Yeah.
So Rick and Sidney Perry helped get funding or something. They set up some deal at the Small Animal Clinic at Texas A&M for veterans that their service dogs need veterinary care for. Do you know about that?
Yeah, so that happened in 2018, 2019, and they did that with the Gary Sinise Foundation.
About that guy.
Yeah. No, I've known Gary for since I started
doing
this. Yeah. Kaya, the reason that I set up Kaya's Canines was because before You know, I never had to worry about her veterinary care because the Gary Sinise Foundation or Gary himself or other people would cover the cost of her care at the small animal clinic at Texas A&M. Mm. And it was after I graduated and left and went to D.C. that they set up that permanent thing at A&M. But it's not a national program. And so when Kaya got sick and ultimately I had to put her down, the video of her last flight on Southwest went stupid viral.
Oh, like I think I saw that.
Yeah, it was it was viewed by, like, at this point, I think 300 million people.
Yeah, and, I've seen that.
So I wanted to find a way to honor her legacy more permanently. Mm-hmm. And since veterinary care is not covered, even by, like, the largest service dog providers, because it's a huge expense for them, mm-hmm. I wanted to set this up. So I set up Kaya's Canines to cover the cost of veterinary care for veteran service dogs. And that's that was so my
nice. Well, I don't know how people have pets at this day and age.
Yeah.
I take our two labs and it's $1,000 just to get the shots.
Oh, yeah. Rigby.
I mean, you can't have kids and pets these days. You know? We got to give one of them up.
Pet insurance is expensive. It's unbelievable. You have to
give one up.
It's freaking unbelievable.
Yeah.
When Rigby was reaching the end of his life, he was really sick and just needed. Marcus was actually out of town for his annual Red Wing thing he does with the guys. And I was freaking out because he wasn't breathing very well. And I took him to our normal vet and they said I need to take him to an emergency clinic. And they wanted $9,000 up front.
Yeah.
And then it was going to be more after they saw him. And I'm like, what?
Yeah.
How in the world does somebody pay for this? And I actually called Rick Perry crying and I was like, I don't know what to do. They want this. And I already spent this amount at the vet and I didn't want to bother Marcus with it because it was Red Wing weekend. And he said, take him to A&M. And they didn't want to release Rigby. It was this big thing. And I ended up taking him up there and they kept Rigby comfortable until Marcus could get there. And it ended up being on the anniversary of Operation Red Wing when Rigby had to be put down. Oh my gosh, it was so heavy.
It gave you something heavier than that. The dude who walked, met me at the door's name was Michael. So he was just like, hey, I got this. I was losing my mind.
Yeah.
That was the only time I was freaking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it major props to Texas A&M, Small Animal Clinic.
Best school in the country. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Country Harbor.
I mean,
man.
The freaking when great. Kaya got sick, and the reason I took her on that last flight is, you know, she's a Texas girl. I wanted her to be, you know, laid to rest where she was born. And so a friend of mine works for Southwest, and I told him, and she couldn't walk. She had cancer, and spread everywhere. So they met us out at the curb with, like, a padded thing and took us through security. Jake Elsie was there on the flight. And
how great is he?
He's a great guy. I love him. So
pilot.
Yeah. And he,
I hate those guys, man. They're always good. You know whatever,
they're just
man.
So good looking. And like, he's always just dressed like very well. And
talk about uniforms. Whatever.
Yeah.
Good for you, pilots.
Yeah.
Way
Marcus
to go.
And Jake are very close. So he's only saying that as a razz.
Yeah. Tell him I said it. Tell him.
Yeah.
He loves Jake.
I mean, tell him I said it. Good for you. You're good looking. So what?
Yeah.
Way to go.
Pal. You're good looking. Yeah. You fly jets. Like, come on, get out of here. But, We when we got back to Texas, we went down to Texas A&M, and we, you know, they let us kind of go around campus. The vice president's office gave us, like, a graduate student and one of those golf carts to go around and take her. Went to the Bush Library in that lake, and that was, you know, her final hours. Like, the assistant dean of the small animal clinic was the one that actually showed up and on a Saturday.
Dude, if I get sick, I want you to take me to A&M
that night. The big
seriously.
Animal clinic.
The big animal clinic. Just drop me in there and just let them go to work, man. That place is renowned for that.
It's fantastic. It's great. And the people are just fantastic. I miss Texas. Living in D.C., you
they actually want to be there, I feel. Like. Yeah. When you walk in there, it's what a hospitals would feel like. They're excited. They're like, not excited. You're fucking, I mean, you're messed up, but they're like, hey, we got you. We'll fix you up. They got you, man.
Yeah. They're just nice humans. They're great. So, I mean, I had great experiences with them.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So you do the Kaya's
canines.
And you did the PAWS Act. What else are you working on?
So my full-time day job, actually, I'm the executive director of a national veteran nonprofit called Mission Roll Call.
Mm-hmm.
We have about 1 million veterans on our opted-in text email list, and we work with Congress, the VA, the White House. Anytime there's a piece of legislation or something that a member of Congress, you know, wants information about how veterans in their district, state, or, you know, the nation feel about something, we can poll them on that policy, the veterans, and kind of give the members of Congress instantaneous feedback on what they feel about that piece of legislation. So that's, and we also go around the country. Last year, we went to 10 veteran heavy areas of the country to get ground truth about what they were dealing with, proposed changes to policy or regulation or things like that, and get an idea of what veterans on the ground are just talking about, which is why routinely our number one priority is suicide prevention. And that's what we talk about on Capitol Hill.
So is there a place where you can recall all of us? Like, there needs to be a place where every veteran, once you become a veteran, here's your veteran email, and we all see the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and if how you need do you to get recall a hold of us them?
If something went down?
Well, they have to opt in, right?
And how do people know about it?
I've never even heard
of
it.
We've never heard of it.
And I, you know, guys, when we get out of the military, some will go to the country. They won't talk to anybody. They'll get a job. They won't tell anybody they were in the military.
Yeah.
I just think there should be an app or something that we can all see in the morning, like a newsletter.
Yeah. Or even part of your Dears account or something. Yeah. Like, it needs to be on something that you check.
I mean, you guys know this as well as I do. I mean, some guys get out and they just want nothing to do with it.
I get it.
They want nothing to do with the bureaucracy. They don't want to do the VA because they've heard horror stories. You know, they're certainly not going to maintain their accurate information on the IRR list and stuff like that in case World War III breaks out. But, part of me, I don't
think... What about what veterans are doing? Like, that someplace where you could check in and you could see where, hey, these guys are having... These Marines, there's two of them left. They're having a reunion here.
Yeah.
So we could send over some props or do something. We don't have anything like that.
I mean, the closest thing I can think of is the Independence Fund has something called Operation Resiliency that hosts people, specific units. The problem is there's like 60,000 veteran nonprofits in the United States. I would argue that 1/3 of them are actually doing real good, meaningful work. And for veterans getting out, it becomes paralysis by analysis because you have all these options. Lost in it. Yeah.
Too many options.
And there's no portal that you can go to. The closest thing to that is America's Warrior Partnership, the dinner where we met. They have a network. It's literally called The Network, where you go online, and if you need a national or local resource, you submit your information, what you need, transportation, acute financial care, and a case manager will reach out to you.
We don't have anything. If you're rolling in, there's an app. Like, if you roll into a town, you hit it, and it tells you where the VFW is, where the...
Like, all your resources
are. Where everything is. Hey, there's a freaking MEP center out over here.
Giving you an idea.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's
a bunch of Marines that live right here. Yeah. There's a bunch of this, that, and the other over here.
Well, and Governor DeSantis actually promoted this at one of his events recently, like a portal that you can go to that the VA, you know, has. The problem with that is that the VA tends to mess up all the tech stuff that they have.
Yeah, electronic where are our nerds health at? Record. I know we have them. We have them in the military. I've seen them.
It's more the bureaucracy and trying
I've
to get...
I've seen them. I know we got them.
Yeah, I mean...
This shouldn't be a problem for us, damn it.
You know, between Silicon Valley and Austin, Texas, and it really shouldn't be. I think it's more the, you know, trying to contract.
I think
and
we got some slackers. That's what it is, man. Yeah. Somebody.
I think so.
We need to tighten up the shoelaces back on this and freaking get our boys and girls back together. It's too much fun when we're working together, the way it works, for us to have these complications.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, we're not doing it right if we got people killing themselves.
Yeah.
So to get on your mission roll call, how do people do that?
Just go to missionrollcall.org and you can sign up for the text and email. It'll ask you some basic information, obviously, like where you're from, what branch of service, how many years of service, things like that.
Do you have the ID me?
No, so we don't, but we have a data analyst that like goes through the data. So like somebody self-reports that they're a World War II veteran and mm-hmm. their data like doesn't match up with that, all the other answers that they respond to. We have somebody that goes in and removes people that are obviously lying about things mm-hmm. that they're reporting. But
I think we should have a special organization like Men in Black that actually shows up to remove those people from doing that.
Yeah.
That's the worst thing you could do is that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. We don't only have veterans on our email list. Sometimes we want to ask families. We want to ask caregivers things. And so we have options that you can kind of self-report that you are a caregiver or you are this or that. Because some of our questions we ask.
So I'm actually going to do it right now so I have, so we can do this together.
Okay.
mission roll call.
.org, yep.
And to go to sign up. Can we sign up? Oh, get involved.
Is yeah, that what get you involved, do? Yeah.
Sign me up. Okay. There you go. Super easy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah.
People can just go to missionrollcall.org.
Well, and the polls that we put out, they're text and email polls. This is the beauty of it. You know, we ask questions. We say, you know, do you use VA community care? And if they answer yes, how often have you used community care? Something like that. It takes 30 seconds to answer these questions. Like, we're not asking you for a lot of time, but it's something that can we can give directly back to. I'll give you an example. And part of what we do is that, you know, the American Legion, the VFWs, you have, say a veteran has an idea for a piece of legislation or something like that. They have to submit a proposal to their local post, and then that post goes to their state convention. The state convention votes on it before it can go to the national convention. National convention sends it to the DC office, and those are the people that actually lobby on Capitol Hill for this piece of legislation. So it has to go through those layers of bureaucracy. We wanted to cut through all that and get right to the veteran, ask questions, and get their collective voice back to policymakers. And sometimes we ask questions, like when President Biden wanted to do student loan forgiveness, right? We didn't see other prominent veteran organizations that have a particular interest in education putting out anything about that, pro or against. So we asked veterans, like, do you support this or do you oppose this? And like 77% said that they opposed it. And we were the only people that did any. I mean, I got a lot of crap for that because people viewed it as kind of a partisan way and we're a nonprofit. But nobody else was doing that. And mm-hmm. so I felt like it was something that the veteran perspective needed to be included because it does kind of degrade the incentive of the GI Bill. You know?
So do people reach out to you that have things that they want passed?
All the time, yeah, and that's more so when we go do the trips down to veteran areas of the country. We have those personal conversations, and they say, you know, I have this idea, and I, you know, why don't we do this? Why don't we do that?
So do keep a binder, because I would imagine some of our guys come up with some pretty good ideas.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I mean, some stuff you would never want to implement.
Yeah. Also that.
You know what I'm talking about? I know that y'all have to have that. Like, oh, hey, you have to read this.
That would be Marcus. Yeah. He
that department, whatever with... that door is, like complaints, you know, just put me in there. I'm like, I mean, you're not going to believe what this dude wants to do, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Marcus always has the biggest, like, Walt Disney imagination for veterans.
Yeah. Hey man, somebody's got to. I mean, what the hell?
Well, I mean, with the status quo being what it is, we need more crazy speak. Like,
what are you talking about, man? Nobody else sticking up for us.
Like, revolution, not revolutionary, but like, we need more bold ideas because, you know, I mean, we haven't made meaningful progress on suicide. We haven't made meaningful, I mean, the Mission Act, access to care, community care, that sort of stuff. We made some pretty decent progress on wait times and things like that. But so many of the things that we were talking about that were problems 20 years ago, we're still talking about today. Mm-hmm. And you got to ask yourself why, right? The VA's budget was $54 billion in 2001. It's now 340-something billion. They've hired over 250,000 full-time employees since 2001. Their budget and their staff have grown exponentially. And we're still not making progress on suicide. We're still not making a whole lot of progress on wait times. We are making progress. Why? Right? Like, what's the reason? We have all these resources, but we're not fundamentally fixing the problem.
I'm trying to send the people onto the person, onto the soldier, as opposed to sending the soldier into the people. It's all out there.
Yeah.
Most of those nonprofits and then the organizations and the towns themselves, you just send them in there and they'll heal them. We have everything we need. It's just we need to streamline it.
Yeah.
It's pretty exceptional. That's why I don't get down on it. I'm like, hey, I know the fix is, like, we have everything we need. Yeah. We just have to organize it.
Well, in 2020, but Congress passed the Commander John Scott Hannon Act, which in the bill, it was a mental health bill. My contention is that we need to stop looking at suicide as mental health. It's not all mental health. Like, usually it's a conglomeration of acute financial stress, relationship stress, lack of transportation to be able to go to a healthcare appointment or go to your job or whatever.
PTSD, man. Pissed off, tired, stoned, or drunk.
I mean, it's parts of the human condition. It's like stuff that you can't fix and with mental health appointments. You can get deep into that. Yeah. And even,
I get that.
But even if you want to, even if it was a mental health condition, like the traditional approach of pills and therapy has not worked objectively.
So, I don't know how that was a good idea. I had to go down that route too. I had a blast. No one else did.
No. Yeah.
No one else had a blast when we were having a good time.
Yeah.
Apparently.
Yeah.
So now that we know that that doesn't work.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, we had to road test it. I mean, that's just what we do in the military.
Yeah. But now what's the other option? Yep.
So when you do your surveys, what have you seen the feedback is from all these veterans about how to curb the suicide rate?
Yeah. It's a great question, and one probably the one I get most often from when I, you know, do podcasts or anything like that. Inside the Commander John Scott Hannon Act, there was a provision called the Staff Sergeant Parker Gordon Fox Grant Program. And this grant program provides up to $750,000 a year per organization, local and state organizations that are on the ground doing the Lord's work in suicide prevention. They may not be suicide prevention programs, but they may be helping veterans with transportation, helping veterans with acute financial stress, upstream problems. Like, we don't want to wait till a veteran has to call a crisis line. We don't want to wait until they already have these issues and they're spiraling and these symptoms. Catch them when they're having these problems before it becomes a critical mass of despair and they decide to put a gun in.
What seems to happen when they get out? So the transition to getting out needs to change.
Well, it's like
I mean, it's a combination. Transition needs to change, but then our approach to intervening, it needs to be upstream. Stop being reactionary. And that's a fundamental problem with the VA is that you're asking them to call the crisis line and you're asking them to see a counselor and get pills when there's already a problem, right? When there's already a problem that is metastasized to such a point that they have no hope and they feel despair.
They don't have a problem anymore. They got a problem with pills.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's what it turns into.
Yeah.
They go in there for one thing, it fixes it, but then the thing that fixed it becomes the problem.
Yeah. And then you've got to take another pill for the side effects of that pill. Another one, then I knew.
And our guys and girls are smart enough to know that's a never-ending cycle. We don't play like that.
So I hate the pills.
Yeah.
So much.
I mean, I had a friend of mine who at one point, he was on 9 different medications. 9. I'm like, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean,
a 35-year-old.
I mean, and it's just, you get so far down that rabbit hole that it becomes so hard to yank yourself out of it, right? And the Fox Grant program gives money to these nonprofits that are fixing these kind of upstream problems. But VA has a record historic budget, and it is less than 0.1% of their record budget. It's a tiny percentage, and it's housed within the mental health department. The VA is like a large ship with a very small rudder. Anytime you want to change it, it takes a long time to change it directions.
Which is a good thing most of the time.
Yeah. I mean, second largest federal agency in the government and the largest healthcare system in the country. Their consistency is good.
Why don't the congressmen and senators have to use the VAs?
I think the House and the Senate have their own, like, you know, Cadillac healthcare.
Or is that us to keep them out? Because if you didn't serve, we don't want you in our house.
Yeah.
Marcus said this several years ago, and I think it's one of the best things that he's ever said is
Will you marry me?
Yes.
That was a good one.
That was. We just had our anniversary, by the way.
Yeah. Oh, congratulations.
Yes. When you said about all public servants should have to use the VA.
Yeah.
Our president, our congressmen, our senators, everyone that works for the government should have to use the VA.
Yeah. I mean, I've always used the VA. I worked for Senator Burr.
And why can't we recruit the best doctors out of school, but out of the community? So I know they rate each other.
Yeah.
And if you rate in the top 10, we're snagging you.
Yeah.
And we'll pay you whatever you're worth. We can do that. And then you can go about your way. But our guys and girls should have the best. That shouldn't be an issue.
Yeah. The problem you have is that there's a common saying amongst veterans, like if you've been to one VA, you've been to one VA, because some of them are great. You know, yeah, some of them are good. Other ones are terrible. Ironically, the one in D.C., which should be the Taj Mahal of VAs because of its proximity to the White House, Congress, and the VA, is awful. It's the one I use. But, you know, the one in North Texas is pretty good. We did a survey of veterans there, and they all really like their care at that VA. So I feel like some of them do, but it's the problem is it's such a massive organization that it's hard, even when Congress says, you guys need to do this, this is a reform we want you to make. Implementation of that in different areas of the country, like implementation in LA is going to be completely different than it's going to be in Bozeman, Montana.
I get that. That's, right? That's the same thing with Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine.
Yeah.
I completely understand.
Different cultures.
Different cultures. Yeah. But we have the money. The money is in there, so it's just a matter of...
Yeah, you're damn right we got the money.
Yeah, we got the money, so it's just a matter of getting it done.
Yeah.
So when you're doing these surveys about suicide, and you're saying that there is money that's going to, you know, that was pushed through this act, there's money that's going to different organizations that help with the upstream, what are those organizations?
You can find a list if you just Google Staff Sergeant Parker Gordon Fox grants. The VA is required to disclose who they give all that money to.
Do you know, like, what kind of organizations?
Well, so of the last few years, I know organizations like America's Warrior Partnership, the one that I talked to, they got a grant. I think Wounded Warrior Project got a grant. Like, I think the problem with the implementation of this so far has been that some organizations, you know, not necessarily Wounded Warrior Project, but it's meant for local organizations, right, that are doing work on the ground that have mm-hmm. the interface with the veterans. And because they only gave organizations like a 1 month window to apply, a lot of the smaller organizations didn't have the time to do that because they don't have a full-time grant writer on staff. They don't have, it's a full-time job mm-hmm. reporting back to the VA for that much money. So, some of the state level organizations and larger organizations that don't necessarily need the money got money. Mm. But yeah, you can look up the full list, on VA's website, but still it's $174 million over a 3-year period, which is, again, less than 0.1% of the VA's budget. And it needs to be expanded because less than 50% of veterans even use the VA, yeah. like are even enrolled in VA healthcare.
Yeah.
Right. And so,
think about that. Not even have, and then, so those that do have that kind of budget,
yeah.
if you took that budget and gave and spread it equally yeah. among all the veterans, yeah. how much would that be? Astronomical.
Yeah,
I mean, you could go into anywhere at any time and have anything done, no matter yeah. what. Then go out and buy a new Cadillac.
Well, that's every not day. So there's 18.4 million veterans, or 17.4 million veterans in the United States per the census in 2021. Like I said, less than half of them, I think 9 million ish, are enrolled in VA. But even fewer than that, I think it's like 4 million a year that actually use the VA on a recurring basis. The 9 million is just people that are enrolled in the VA system, sure. yeah, right? Sure. So there's like 4-ish million veterans that use it on a regular basis.
Let's say 5.
You got a budget of $340-something billion and 450,000 employees.
That's so nuts.
Think about that.
It's huge, right?
But think, like, about that money that can go to each one of those people and the staff.
Yeah.
That is nuts.
How yeah. is there a problem?
Yeah. Well, there's, again, implementation.
When you say it out loud like that, it sounds pretty simple.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it does, but... you have issues with different employees, like accountability.
Oh, I know what the problem is. Yeah, I get that. I get that. We come into play. Humans.
Yeah.
We get in the way.
Yeah. And well, it's...
I would be curious to somehow survey... Okay, so these organizations got this funding. How many lives did they save? Like, statistically, were there the same amount of suicides in that area, if it's supposed to be local organizations? So is it actually helping? Yeah. Like, how do you monitor that?
That's tough. I mean, each of these organizations are required to provide the VA with, this is how many veterans we've helped and referred to these organizations, or referred for things. It's hard to prove a counterfactual, though. Like, you can't prove, like, we stopped this person.
Well, you can't prove it, but you can yeah. just take statistically how many people are committing suicide.
Well, that's
in
a
this
whole
area.
Other problem is the VA gets their data from the CDC nationally on suicides. And there was another organization that did a study that is saying that the VA wildly undercounts suicides because they don't count largely overdose deaths, because the CDC gets their death data from states. Every state codes certain deaths different ways. So California, Texas, they'll do collection of death data. They don't have a uniform system to say that this person was definitely a veteran. The DOD does not share data with states that says this is all the people in your state that did serve, right? So not everybody gets tagged as a veteran when they kill themselves using pills. The VA, different states don't code it as a suicide because it's like an accidental overdose. They call self-injury mortality. So they collect that data. It goes to the CDC. The CDC gives it to the VA. So the data might be wrong, right? Mm. We don't really know how to analyze it.
I've always wondered how that's actually
I got a question about that, too. So the budget that the VA has, it gets... They get that same amount of money every year?
Marcus is they get too much money.
It changes. The VA's budget since 2018...
They get more money every year.
Typically, yeah.
Okay, so we just established how much money for 1 year could go to every veteran and the staff, and most of us don't even use that money.
Yeah.
So it rolls over to the next year, but we need the same amount coming in?
A lot of that money is, so more than half of the money that they get every year, as with all other government programs, you have mandatory spending and you have discretionary spending. Discretionary spending is like the stuff Congress has to appropriate every year. It's money for healthcare. It's money for
this, that. That's what they're arguing about.
Yeah, it's what they argue about. Mandatory funding is like Social Security. Congress does not have an option to pay it out. And for veterans, that includes disability compensation. That includes GI Bill payments. That includes things that like the VA has to give you.
I get that.
If you,
and then on top of that, we had that $3-something billion.
For the VA.
If I gave you that amount of money in 1 year and you came back to me the next year and said you needed the same amount of money and we already fixed what was wrong with you, I wouldn't understand that.
Yeah. I mean, the VA last year for this record budget, they argued, somewhat correctly that healthcare costs have inflation's a thing for everybody, including for
because people use the VA as their regular, it's their regular healthcare.
Yeah. And
I was talking to a guy about that.
Yeah.
I go, hey, why don't we just give all of our guys and girls an ID, their ID when they get out, they can go into any hospital they want. And then we like having our own thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the team.
Well, I completely understand the concept, but I didn't think about it till they said it to me. I didn't think about it like that. I was like, yeah, we got a section of our guys and girls that live that. They love it. And that's their thing. It's our thing.
Yeah.
Whether you hang out in it all the time or you don't, I'm just now getting to where I really enjoy the veteran space. Yeah. it just took me a minute. That's just the way it is. But now when I run into them, it's a ball.
Yeah.
And I understand that.
Yeah. I mean, that's a huge argument, too, for a long time.
I get it. I understand. I completely understand it.
Like, the Mission Act passed, and that was a way... The Phoenix waitlist scandal back in 2014, where veterans were dying on secret waitlists, right? The Congress passed CHOICE and then passed the Mission Act in 2018, and that gave veterans the option to go use community care providers. A lot of people were like, certain people want to privatize the VA, right? Which wasn't the case, because, again, the VA's budget has increased every year, and we've been doing all this stuff.
Privatize it for us.
But, like, if you want to use it, if the VA cannot provide you care within a certain time or distance, they should automatically refer you to community providers.
Yeah.
Right? That met with some resistance, and there's still a debate today going on. Like, should we give veterans, should we account for veterans' preference on what they want to do? The answer is, of course we should, right?
But isn't that what TRICARE is?
Well, TRICARE is for people that are like retired or like dependents on active duty and stuff like that. Like,
so you can't get TRICARE if you don't retire.
Correct.
Didn't know that. I actually didn't know that we were eligible for TRICARE until 2018. Yeah. We got married in 2010.
Yeah.
I paid private insurance for us for 8 years.
Yeah.
Not knowing. I had no one coached me on any of the military stuff. And Marcus,
I never claimed any of my benefits.
Marcus never thought about it or anything.
I didn't think about them.
We had this huge, our whole family, literally all of us, came down with the most horrible flu in 2018, like in January or something. And our freaking deductible was stupid huge. It was like $2,000 per person. Yeah. We all were in the hospital. And I was like, why do we have to pay all this money? And somebody said, why don't you have TRICARE? Yeah.
And can I just pause real quick and say how ridiculous it is that you, of all people, didn't know what your benefits were? Like, nobody thought to be like, hey, Marcus, you know, this is what you need to go do. And I mean, the level of communication and messaging when people get out, whether you're medically retired or you retire after 20 years or blended retirement or whatever the case may be, like, there needs to be really a reverse boot camp where people get sat down and they get taught all this stuff. These are your resources and this is what you want to do. Sometimes I get kind of dejected. Like, working in DC is awful enough because it's a very transactional town and it's very transient. It's hard to make good friends there, and people are just frankly not as friendly as they are in Texas. But you feel like you have the same.
Clear, there's no other place like Texas.
There is not. God bless. But you feel like you have sometimes the same conversations with the same people about the same problems over and over again. And little, if anything, really changes meaningfully. Now, again, I think we have made meaningful progress over the last, you know, 5-6 years. But sometimes I'm just saying it feels like when you're in this, it's slog. It's a slog.
Marcus, and I don't know who gets this and who doesn't, but he had a CARE Coalition advocate. Let's just say she didn't like me.
Yeah. Is that the SOCOM CARE Coalition?
Yes.
Yeah.
And she just didn't like me. That's all I'm going to say. There's nothing false about that. Yeah. So I received no information.
Yeah.
And then there was her no more. So we didn't have anybody else that took her place.
Yeah.
And that's where the communication fell through. But there should have been someone giving us information about all of our, I still don't know what all of our benefits are. I just know that we're eligible for TRICARE.
That's how you know Jim Lorraine, right? Yeah. SOCOM CARE Coalition. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, and backing up to your point, like, no knock on special operations in the community, mm-hmm. but like, it's a tight knit community. There's a lot of attention focused on that community because of the work that, you know, that they do. For the general population, there's like even less than what the special operations community has. And frankly, the special operations community, you know, you've got a lot of different foundations and things like that, where there's a lot of attention paid from corporate and business leaders and sponsors because, you know, it's the high speed part of the military that mm-hmm. gets a lot of focus and attention. And so there are more resources on the civilian probably side than there are for like the average veteran. Mm-hmm. And it's easier to navigate because it's a smaller group of people where word of mouth is easier. Like, hey man, you're having this problem. Like, go see my buddy at this foundation mm-hmm. or this nonprofit. Right. So it just, every time I hear stories like that, it astounds mm-hmm. me that even like you did not know and did not have as much as the resources and good things that you guys have that you didn't know.
Yeah. It blew my mind when I found out we didn't have to pay whatever it was. It was a ridiculous amount every month for private insurance. And I just found out in 2018. It went into effect in 2019, and I haven't been happier about insurance.
I earned that.
I earned that. I know. I'm like, babe, we actually have insurance. This is awesome.
I'm about it.
Yeah. Well,
'cause I spend a lot of time in the hospitals, man.
Yeah.
That's how I get, when I wake up in there, I know I get to rest.
Yeah.
And you truly put out if you're bleeding, right? That's how you know, man. If you end the day bleeding, that means you had a hard day.
Yeah.
If you wake up in the hospital, it's vacation time.
Yeah.
Well, I love that you're doing all this stuff for veterans, and you've got...
Yeah, what kind
of... Yeah, the
Kai's Canines.
Kai's Canines. Yeah. How can people find out about that?
KK9S.org. You can go. Honestly, it's I don't pay myself from that. But we're doing great work. We have already helped 10 veterans and their dogs who have, one got hit by a car, a single mother of four that's a total disabled veteran, $6,000 vet bill that we covered for her. So doing good work there. Mission Roll Call, obviously we already talked about how people can get involved in that. So
yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thanks again for coming out, brother.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Telling your story. That's cool. We definitely get passionate about all the veteran stuff. Anything. Yeah. And Marcus wants to create this big network or somehow create where everyone can get in touch with each other. There needs to be some sort of interactive networking.
I've seen us move in the battle space. Like the way we can coordinate and get things done. Yeah. And we're large, but we're not that large.
Yeah.
And I've been around too. The greatest gift I got when I got my ass kicked like that, it opened a lot of doors. I get to go into y'all's houses, and now I get to see all this. I'm like, hey, man, I'm going to get this done. I'll get it done. I don't know how I'm going to get it done, but there should be no transition from the time you go in to the time you get out. You just take the uniform off, get your civilian clothes, but your benefits, everything.
Yeah.
It's just seamless. Get in your town, get a job. I don't care what it is. But not worrying about dumb stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure, the last thing I'll just say is that it can be frustrating sometimes working in this community just because you feel like there are problems that are unsolvable. But I'm constantly going around the country heartened by what veterans are doing to continue to serve their communities and to continuing to serve their state and our country. And especially at a time where we seem so massively divided, we could have the ability to take those lessons of like shedding our differences and coming together and working together as a team. I'm proud that Texas right now leads the nation with the number of veterans serving in Congress at 11. We've got a state that has had two presidents who served, and there's a strong tradition.
You want to do another podcast right now about Texas, but I'll do
I could talk about Texas all day long. My girlfriend's from Long Island, and the first time she ever rode a horse was when we went down here.
Dude.
And I talk to her all the time about every time we come down here and it's a shining day, I'm like, God has shined his countenance down upon Texas.
I made a song about it.
We've got Whataburger, Tex-Mex, frozen margarita machine is in the Smithsonian in D.C. Like, what do you want? What more do you want? Greatest state in the country.
I mean,
only state that was a former country. Like, what do you want? What do you want from us?
So Marcus and I, we talked about it a lot, and we haven't really done it, but we talked about doing this thing at the end of every podcast called Texas Tidbits.
Oh, let's do it.
And we give somebody just some valuable information about Texas. I know we just mentioned a few, but is there any thing that you would tell someone from, like your girlfriend from New York?
So we're saying, like, if you move here.
Oh, yeah.
Because we got such an influx from California.
I got the perfect thing.
So here is our Texas tidbit.
Every time I mention this to people, it blows their mind that we have an entire year in seventh grade that it is mandatory that you have to take a year of Texas history.
Yeah.
And they're like, what kind of cult is it down there? And I'm like, yes. And we also say the Pledge of Allegiance to Texas after we say the Pledge of Allegiance to the United States. They're like, what are you guys doing down there? I'm like, we're raising people that are proud of their state. What do you want?
When I was in school, and cause I went to a small private school, and all my kids go to the same private school. I don't know if public schools do this or not, but we, in seventh grade, we do the Texas tour. And you go to the Capitol.
Oh, yeah.
You go to the Alamo with your grade. Like, it's a big field trip. Like, was it 3 days?
It was a few days long.
Yeah. Like, you actually, and when Hunter was in seventh grade, Rick Perry was acting governor, and he actually met with the class in the.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. In the Capitol. It was really, really cool.
Yeah.
But you had to go do all these different things. And then on top of that, it was mandatory that you took pictures in front of like 20 different historical markers and explained what they were. So, come on. That's really cool.
Also, fun fact, the Texas State Capitol is taller than the United States Capitol.
Yes.
You know.
I love that.
And we invented the frozen margarita machine for anybody that likes margaritas.
You're welcome.
Those are great Texas tidbits.
I love that one.
I'm sorry. I packed in three in one.
Dr. Bluebell.
Pepper.
Yeah.
Whataburger and Bucky.
We have such
a Texas hat trick. To hit all three of them.
Talk about United States soft power. Texas has soft power. I go to Italy and I tell people like I'm from Texas. They're like, oh, you're a cowboy? And I'm like, well, I mean, not everybody rides their horses to church on Sunday in Texas. I mean, I did, but like not everybody does, you know?
I saw my frat brothers ride their horses into the bar.
So it's still a thing. And there's a difference. When they say cowboy, you could say, oh, Texans.
Yeah.
It's like Cowboys fan, Dallas Cowboys, or Houston Texans.
Yeah.
So that's a split with the Texans.
Yeah.
Well, being a Texan.
Or more recently in the World Series, or not the World Series, the ALCS.
That was so difficult.
Houston and the Rangers.
It's like rooting for your kids, right? Yeah. It's like, man, people ask me about it. I was like, how'd it go? I was like, well, I was born in Houston, and I'm right at the line of when that goes down. But if there's somebody playing from Texas, you have to
wait for them. I mean, I remember because I went to A&M in 2006. Texas was in the national championship against USC. And there is no love lost between Texas and
A&M.
That was
a great game.
But I rooted for Texas because I'm like, I'm going to root for the Texas team.
That was
a
great game.
Great game. Greatest college football.
Freaking great game.
But that was an amazing
greatest college football game of all time. And it pains me to say that as an A&M graduate, but like, you know, they had two Heisman Trophy winners, Leinart and Bush, and then Lendale White was running all over them, and Vince Young, last minute, fourth and five.
We have Matthew McConaughey.
Matthew McConaughey.
Thank you.
You're all right, all right, all right. Yeah.
And Sandra Bullock lives here.
And Dennis Quaid.
And
Dennis Quaid. Dennis Quaid's got an initiative right now where he's trying to get, and Matthew McConaughey are trying to get more actors to come act in Texas. That's a huge thing.
So
right
we should, we're recruiting all the kick-ass actors. Yeah.
Woody
military.
Harrelson.
We also have right
all
here.
All these men
from,
help raise him. Hey, raise me, man.
Okay, we are on the Tomball Magnolia border. That's our little towns that we live in. In Tomball, you've got Lyle Lovett.
Mm.
Is from Tomball.
Yeah.
Our local Chili's is dedicated to him.
Jimmy Butler.
And Jimmy Butler.
Yeah.
Cody Johnson.
We could go on forever.
George Strait.
Oh, gosh.
Nolan Ryan.
George Strait, Nolan Ryan. Like, come on.
We
I mean, California, get out of here.
We
with
have your the Eli Young band.
Roger Clemens.
From
yeah. I mean, do we even need. We should stop there.
Yeah.
I
mean, well, Troy Aikman.
We can go on forever.
Troy Aikman.
So that's our Texas tidbits for today.
Yeah. Texas tidbits.
Joe Rogan lives here now, and we have Elon.
Yeah. We have the coolest state.
I think
we do have Elon, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and he doesn't live here, but Jeff Bezos is building some, you know, clock in West Texas that's going to survive humanity.
So, I don't know. Okay. Texas will survive.
Yeah.
We'll survive.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Well, thank you so much for coming down. Really interesting talk, learned a lot. Uh-huh. And for all the listeners out there, thank you for listening in, and we will see you guys next week.